I would like to welcome to Radio Gorgeous the phenomenal Bonnie McBird, who is an author. She's worked in theater, in film, documentary, television, actor, writer, playwright. There's nothing she doesn't do. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
We're here talking about Unquiet Spirits, which is the second in a series of at least three Sherlock Holmes-themed novels. Tell us about Unquiet Spirits, and then we'll get to the other ones and go from there.
Great. Well, you can hear this siren right now, and we are just off Baker Street, as a matter of fact. I have loved Sherlock Holmes since I was a little teeny kid at 10. I read the first one, and then I sort of inhaled the whole thing. And Unquiet Spirits is a novel written in the style of Arthur Conan Doyle, or as close as I can be, not being him, but emulating him, because I love his work. But he wrote short stories and novellas, and this is a full-length novel. And it takes place in 1889, and it takes Holmes and Watson, it's in Watson's voice, first person, as the originals were, takes Holmes and Watson up to the Highlands, and also to the south of France, but ultimately to the Highlands, where they are involved in a mystery and a series of murders around a castle and distillery, whiskey distillery. So Unquiet Spirits refers to both ghosts and whiskey, and it examines the notion of what happens when you don't deal with ghosts from your past.
And unpicking all a bit of that, first off, this is such close fan fiction, and I don't mean to be condescending when I say fan fiction. I mean it as a compliment, because you have been so faithful to Arthur Conan Doyle's version of Sherlock Holmes. Because other people have, you know, we see it on TV, we see it in the movies, they've modernized, they've distorted, they've played with it. But you stuck very, very closely to the true voice of Arthur Conan Doyle. Even down to, you know, Holmes's of the time, his prejudices, you know, the criminal classes and things like that. Why did you stick so closely to it?
Well, that was a choice that I made before I started these books. There's lots of very valid ways to riff on Sherlock Holmes, and I love some of the modernizations, particularly BBC, and I also like the Robert Downey. I really love quite a few of the modernizations and new takes. But what I just set out to do was to emulate, because I think Conan Doyle is a genius. So it's hubris to do this, because, I mean, he is a genius. But but in terms of an artistic goal, it was very inspiring to try to do this and try to understand, like, what is it about his stuff that really works so well? And it's certainly deeply involved with the characters. These two men are, you know, indelible. I mean, Sherlock Holmes is a name that's known everywhere in the world. You can go to the, you know, the tiniest corner of the, you know, the most remote place, and they know Sherlock Holmes. And I think the reason is the friendship, and also this character has a lot of holes in him, so we all kind of fill him in with ourselves. So the thing about these modernizations is they all started by people who love the originals. So Moffat and Gatiss, for example, for BBC Sherlock, I mean, we're avid fanboys of the original stuff. And so all of this stuff comes, you know, stems from them. And so we are all writing fan fiction in that sense. We're fans of the original. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying fan fiction. There's actual, the term usually applies to unprofessional or unpublished, I should say, not unprofessional, unpublished works that appear appear online. There's mm-hmm. forums for this, and there's some massively, there are tons of stuff has been written, some of it quite good. And so we're all writing fan fiction, and Moffat and Gatiss wrote fan fiction, you know what I'm saying? So the thing is, I decided to emulate as closely as possible. I decided to stretch the notion in a few key ways. One is that I was going to write long form, because he wrote, as I said, short stories and novellas. So I decided to try to see what would happen to stretch it to long form. Also, I think in long form because I used to be a screenwriter. and movies, if you look at them structurally, are long form. And so the way the story is constructed, and people use different models for this. They use the hero's journey or this, that, and the other. I use a three-act structure. I also write plays, but I use a three-act structure for the novel, and that allows it to be longer form. Once you do that with Conan Doyle's style of thing, then you have to stretch it in certain ways. First of all, the mystery itself has to be more complicated because Holmes is the smartest man in the world. And if it isn't really, really complicated, he'd just figure it out like that. And then you'd be done by page 30.
And he'd also dismiss the, he wouldn't even accept the challenge.
Yes, yeah, I mean, so. It has to be something that he can't get to the full bottom of until a novel length story. So there's that. Then there's, that's one layer. The other thing is that I felt that with a long form, you needed more, psychological involvement, a little more personal stuff. Now, I wanted to do that very carefully because it does exist in the original canon. You get little hints of it in the stories. You know, in A Scandal in Bohemia, you start to see, this was the woman, you know, and you realize that there's an issue with women that he just doesn't partake. And you don't, and in fact, in the whole canon, you never really find out why. But, you know, and this has been theorized a million different ways by people. So there's little hints, and there's in the Three Garadibs, there's something that the Sherlock Holmes community calls the Three Garadibs moment. And that's where Watson is hurt, and he's like, you know, tell me you're not hurt. He's like, it's this moment where Holmes is, you see this the friendship, the love he has for his friend, and how panicked he is that he thinks he might be dead. So you have these moments that hint at the deeper man. And they're throughout canon, but they're just like little hints. So I feel like the longer form needs a little more of that. But you can't put too much in because then it becomes, you know, you can't make it be a romance. You can't make it be, you know, all psychological thriller because that is not the genre. So I decided to push in that direction. And in each of the two books, I examined one of the mysteries of Sherlock Holmes. The first book, which was Art in the Blood, looks at the perils and the gifts of the artistic temperament, which is something I know quite well. And I'm come from a family of artists. And so basically, Holmes in the canon is a depressive. He's probably bipolar. He's probably a little autistic, just a tiny bit toward the Asperger, we would call now. But so
and
he
self-medicating
and he self-medicates. Exactly. So the first one examined just a little bit, like where those edges are, the artistic temperament, and it also, of course, that theme threaded through the other characters. And there was an art theft. The client was an artist, and so on. So the second book, Unquiet Spirits. Clearly, Holmes has a past. There's something there. There's lots of things there because he's a strange dude, mm-hmm. And he's still Waters. So I wanted to look into those a little bit, but I didn't want to cross the line and solve every mystery because then it's not Holmes anymore, and mm-hmm. and then it becomes a different genre. It's really about the thrill of the adventure. That's the primary goal of these books, is to take you on a good adventure. But I wanted to just hint a little bit more. So in Unquiet Spirits, the spirits refers to whiskey. It also refers to ghosts. And by the way, everybody believes in ghosts in Scotland, or darn close. And so it also has to do with ghosts of your past. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if there was a ghost in Holmes's past that he had to confront and deal with in order to solve the current day mystery? And that was my kind of premise going in, and then I had to come up with the story that made that happen. But so that was my premise, and I thought that would be fun. And so there is a sequence of events in his past that comes to light, comes to Watson, finds out about them, explains a great deal. And he does, and Holmes does have to kind of confront this before the end can be reached. So those are the two. So you see, I am pushing in a couple directions. I'm pushing structurally. I'm pushing in the a little bit of reveal about Holmes, because I like the meat of those moments where we see the real man. But again, not too much.
Yeah. And another place where you expand, I would say, is with Watson, because of his, you know, we would say post-traumatic stress disorder now. And again, you don't get moderny about it, but you do fill that in for us. And that, you know, sort of informs a bit, as you say, those moments with Holmes when he's fearful for Watson. And that really comes up in those moments as well.
Yes, Watson is a fantastic character. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's one of the great inventions of literature also. And I think, interestingly enough, two of the modern versions, the two that I mentioned, BBC and also the Downey, really got Watson right, mm-hmm. based on yeah. the original writing. Because
yeah.
Watson is a hero. He's a man of action. He's a crack shot. He's a gambler. He really likes women. And he is suffering a bit from post-traumatic stress disorder and this feeling of being completely lost after coming out of the war when he meets Holmes. And so Holmes gives him the adrenaline that he is so. There's a great scene in BBC Sherlock in the opening episode. You know, he's like jonesing for it. Yeah, he's basically, you know, you've seen a lot of violence, a lot of violent deaths, and you want to see some more. Right. It's yeah. like yes. So,
but it also gives Watson, which is very valuable to Watson, the sense that he's caretaking or protecting Holmes.
Yes, that's right. It does
well.
Appeal to the doctor in
yeah.
him because
yeah.
because Holmes
and
really
sort of macho.
Yes, yeah, it is. Holmes really is. He's a hero, so he's not a weak person, but he has weaknesses, and he is basically Watson is the perfect companion for him because Watson is sort of always the same.
Well, and also he's us because, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. we don't know what's going on.
Right, he is us.
Know? And also without Watson, he's there to humanize Holmes as
he
well.
He is. And when Holmes gets into his more, what I would call more Asperger-y stuff mm-hmm. with people, Watson is like, hey.
Yeah, hello.
Be
That's
like
not how we do.
Be like a person.
Yeah,
yes, be like
exactly.
a person now. And also, he's us, and he isn't the genius that Holmes is, so he is admiring Holmes, which is fun to do because he is a genius, but he also is, he's just kind of, he's every man, but he's not a stupid every man. Mm-hmm. Watson's a very smart guy, and if you read the canon carefully, I mean, he's incredibly observant about people that come in, and I mean, he may not make all the inferences, but he really sees everything, and so he's quite the man, actually.
And I thought it was also interesting that the whole spirits aspect in terms of ghosts, because that's something that Arthur Conan Doyle himself was very interested in and very steeped in the world of, you know, the seances here in London and the possibilities of the spiritual world and fairies and etc. Whereas Holmes is really a man of science. So are the spirits in some way, is that an homage, you know, sort of to Arthur Conan Doyle as well?
Well, it's interesting. That's a good question. Arthur Conan Doyle came from Edinburgh, and part of Unquiet Spirits is set in Edinburgh. And in Scotland in general, there's a great tradition of ghost stories. And quite a large percentage of the population literally believes in ghosts. My whiskey consultant on this, Charles McLean, said, the question shouldn't be, do you believe, or are there ghosts? The question should be, have you had an encounter with a ghost? Or have you experienced
yeah.
it? So I would say, like, personally, I don't believe in ghosts, but I have had an experience. So, but anyway, up in the and the Highlands, they really do believe. So I think Conan Doyle grew up with those stories and in that environment. And originally, he didn't believe in ghosts. However, it wasn't the late in life conversion that that is so publicized. If you really look at his life story, because even as early as his beginning doctorhood in Portsmouth, when he was quite a young man, he was involved in a society that was not exactly debunking, but kind of like, show us proof, you know, like we're men of science. It was, of course, all men at that time. We didn't get to do the fun stuff so much then. But I'll get to that in a minute too, but anyway, he was there, and he was interested even as a very young man. And later on, I think compelled by the death of in short succession, his first wife, his mother, and his son died relatively close together. And when this happens, one longs for contact, or to at least to believe that there's an afterlife. And so his normal sort of doubting scientific self got pushed toward I really want this to be true.
I want to believe.
Want to believe. And it was the era right then of a massive number of, spiritualists and people doing seances and stuff. And then, of course, there was like people like Houdini. There was like, yeah, right. Let me show you how this is done. So, and they were friends, actually. But so anyway, it was an interesting time. And he wanted scientific proof. Now, even now, there's a place in Edinburgh, which is, in fact, where I did a show at the Fringe last summer, the Arthur Conan Doyle Center. So Unquiet Spirits, we had a little kind of show about, and it's the Arthur Conan Doyle Center is to investigate this stuff. It's a center for spirituality. Now, they have a bigger spirituality tent in that they have readings and stuff, the seances, and health, and they're also health things and so forth. But they're interested, and the woman who runs that is about, she's interested in finding scientific evidence in the same way, in the spirit of Conan Doyle. So that's one of the things they do there, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that work carries on. So.
What can you tell me about the third one, The Devil's Due? I know you're probably working on it now, so I don't know if you can tell us much, but if there's anything you could give us a glimmer of hope, because the first two are, they're hefty and satisfying reads, full of twists, and, they're filled with delicious familiarity, as we were saying, for old fans, new fans, fans of the books, fans of the TV series, etc. So,
I can't say too much about it yet, but it's sort of, it makes Holmes examine, in reading it, the light and dark side of every person. There is definitely a dark side, and the dark side helps the light side be brighter in many ways. So it's basically about the devil within us. And outside of us.
Excellent. And can I ask you, as we're sitting in your flat in Baker Street, is that purposeful? Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
There was no other place.
Yes, it is. It is. Well, here's how this happened. This is kind of crazy. I started coming to London to research the book. And I just on a lark, the first trip of that, I booked into the Sherlock Holmes Hotel in Baker Street for fun, to be silly and fun. And I thought it'd be cool.
And you need to put your head somewhere.
Yeah,
why not there?
And it was it was kind of a mid-range hotel. Comfortable. Anyway, so I got there and it was like really comfortable. It wasn't really kitschy. There were a few Sherlock Holmes things around, but it wasn't kitschy. It was just nice. And it was so convenient. This is an incredibly convenient area because the Baker Street Tube is on like five lines, and there's everything outside your door you need. So like I could print out my manuscript like three doors down. It was just perfect. So I just started staying there, and I wrote half the first book. I wrote half of Art and the Blood in that hotel, in the Sherlock Holmes Hotel. So I just liked it, and I was literally facing Baker Street. And then I just liked the area. And then my husband and I started getting him to come out here. And he's like, I love London. And we both love the city. I know you do.
Yes.
So we decided to get a flat here. And so we were looking in this area.
Nowhere else to be.
Well, I just got used to the area. Regent's Park's my favorite park. It's right like three blocks up the road. So you can go running there. And everything you need is here. It's close to shopping. It's close to the Wigmore Hall. We go to the concerts a lot. It's just close to everything.
They're central, absolutely central.
And my two libraries, I love to go to the Wellcome and the British Library, are just down the road there. So it's perfect.
And you couldn't be more ideally suited.
I know, it's a little silly. I know, it's a bit silly, but it came out of an intention.
It was meant to be.
Right.
We'll leave it at that.
Yes, and this building is from 1890, which is, The Devil's Due is going to be set in 1890, and that's when this building was built. So that is going to happen. That'll be in there.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you for the taster. I want to go back in time a little bit. And because you were one of the screenwriters on Tron. And that seems to me sort of prescient. That was 1982 it came out, which means you were working on it before then.
Which means I'm really old.
You're established or, and experienced.
I was five when I read that. Yeah,
exactly. You were a prodigy. Yeah. It was a child prodigy wrote that. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, starting in the 70s, you were working in film. And I think of that movie as, yeah, I don't know, the Spielberg movie now is almost a remake, you know, of, you know, entering a video game. And I want if you could tell women out there, because, you know, you did it, it sounds to me, you were just, that's what I wanted to do, so I was going to do it, regardless of whosoever. And you've moved into documentary, you've just, I don't know if it's a confidence in you, or just you work on what you're interested in and see what opens up from that, or how have you navigated?
Well, I didn't really orchestrate my career. I did just move from thing to thing that interested me. I got a master's in film from Stanford, so I knew I wanted to work in film. That was primarily documentary oriented. But back then, my master's thesis was teaching children to read using a talking computer. It was a early generation kind of interactive computer experience for tiny children learning to read. It was one of the sort of vanguard uses of this. Anyway, so I was interested in computers and I took computer science at Stanford also. So I was really interested in computers to begin with, and logic. And I was, as I said, a Holmes fan for way back. So anyway, so my thesis was that, and I came to Hollywood to make movies, but I really wanted to write dramatic films. My first job was in documentaries, though, and then I worked at Universal, where I was working in feature films. And I fell in love with long form and feature films, and I did that for 4 years as a development exec. And that's basically like a book editor. Mm-hmm. So I really, it was a great lesson in structure, because I had to analyze all the scripts that were in development at the time, and do some other things, cover theater and so forth. So I left to write Tron. I left to write that movie. And the computer thing was a natural for me, because I was already interested in it. And I went and, you know, researched, and I went up to what was going to become Silicon Valley, but wasn't yet. And I met Alan Kay, who gave the tour to Steve Jobs at Xerox PARC. That, you know, and he's called the father of the personal computer. He's in that room. We married. I hired him as the technical consultant, and we fell in love and married. But anyway, so that thing was very computer oriented and really fun and interesting. But it was also had, you know, a lot of personality. I was the original writer of that movie, so I worked on it for 2 years. It sold and went to Disney, and there were 8 sets of writers after me, as typical Hollywood story. So anyway, I took some money from that. I produced a play, and then I formed a company and did documentaries for 10 years.
And you got 3 Emmys for
those. Yes, yes, uh-huh. And then left that and became an actor for 10 years. Studied Shakespeare over here in Oxford for a summer, and another intensive in the States. Did theater in LA for 10 years, and then I.
Is that another area of sort of concentric circles with your husband? Because I understand is he also a theater set designer? Or?
No. Well, not exactly. He did a lot of theater in college, and he loves theater. So he just loves theater. So in fact, that's one of the ways I got him to come to London.
Exactly. So, like, you're in theater land.
This is theater land. Oh my God, I'm in heaven here. I go several times a month. So yeah. So we have a lot in common. Probably the bigger connection is music. Mm. Music is his avocation. I mean, he just would rather do that really than anything. And I was a music major as an undergrad, so we have that in common. So we got together. We've been together a long time. But as, in terms of career, in terms of being a woman and doing all this. You know, I just never thought about it at all. I just did what I wanted to do. I certainly bumped into resistance, though, very much so. So in the 70s at Universal, there was a weekly meeting every Wednesday in this very fancy room at the top of the tower, you know, and there were 2 women in the room. One was Verna Fields, who was in her 60s and had won an Academy Award for editing, and me. And I was in my 20s, and I was expected not to speak. And that was very clearly set out.
Wow.
And I remember, and I remember thinking, well, because I had a lot of influence. I did, oftentimes I was the only person at a studio to read a script overnight that they were going to bid on. Wow. And I would be the only person to have read it. So essentially they were making my response. So I had a great deal of backstage power, but no overt power. So I couldn't, and then I had
sort of under the line influence.
Yes, and so I knew, you know, they definitely respected me and trusted my instincts and my editorial stuff, but they wouldn't let me run anything.
they didn't want to hear your voice.
Kind of. And what's weird is how they treated this woman, Verna Fields, who was the only filmmaker in the room. She was the only person who actually knew how to make films and what made them good. And she was like, the hell? she was just sort of very natural, very dynamic. And she was frustrated. And they would even shut her up also, an Academy Award winning woman. Anyway, so it was a very challenging time in the 70s. And, you know, gradually it got somewhat better, but it's never been easy for women in power. People have punched through. They have. I don't have the executive kind of personality. I'm a creative. And so, in fact, I wasn't well cast in that role. I just didn't enjoy the politics of that. And there are women who did and did it well. It just wasn't me, and it wasn't a factor about being a woman. It was a factor of being a creative as opposed to a business person. So, and that's basically a business job. So, you know, I've been more happy, or, you know, in the things I've done subsequently in terms of actually hands-on doing stuff. That's what I like to do. And there's less interference for women there. But it's still there. It is still there today. I mean, you look at the statistics of women screenwriters, women directors, women producers. Yeah, we're there, but we're not in as big a numbers as we should be.
And one of the things that you know, will hopefully get more diverse stories and more stories out there, you know, as Frances McDormand is like, we've all got these stories.
Yes, exactly.
And you teach writing. So what are, if because it's my theory that, you know, it's something we opt out of in terms of, you know, say, oh, that would make a great screenplay, not I should write that screenplay, you know, or someone probably will write that screenplay. But so if more of us had, you know, sort of the tools at our disposal, there might be more of those stories being made. So what's your advice to women in terms of approaching a creative project yourself? And why not me? First of all, just put yourself in it, as you have done. But then what's the step after that?
Well, obviously it's belief in yourself. I never really think of myself going into a project or a business situation or anything else as a woman doing this. I'm thinking about the project. I'm not thinking about who I am and, you know, what sex I am. I just think about the project. And it's particularly, so I never enter into anything that I'm doing with that thought, like, will they hear it from a woman? I just do what I'm doing. So when I was at Universal and I bumped up against that, you can't speak. I'm like, what the hell? Why can't I speak? You know, so it never occurs to me that I should be deferential or anything like that. So it just doesn't occur to me. That's what I say. So I just wipe that away. Now I know that the statistics are bad. I know that there's prejudice, et cetera. But I just, in order to do my work, I have to ignore that, completely ignore that. So I don't think about that. But it's a particularly interesting question for me that you're asking, because I'm writing these Sherlock Holmes books as a man. I'm writing in the voice of a man. And I'm writing about two guys, like two bros, basically. I mean, It is the original bromance. And so what does that mean? And it really means nothing, because if you're a really good writer, you are everyone on the page. And in order to write empathically about every character, that just goes away. That who you are goes away. Now, it's underneath there. Your philosophy can't help but seep through. But I love the philosophy that Conan Doyle expresses, which is, you know, men of honor trying to make a just world. I mean, I so love what these two people are about that I can go there easily. And just so it isn't really, I don't think that gets in the way or is even plays in at all. So I feel like I can write male or female characters equally well. Now, that being said, I'm bored if there's not interesting women in the story. I'm really bored. I want to see them. In fact, so, I don't know, in Art in the Blood, the client is a woman, and she's forceful and very competent. She's a singer in Montmartre, and she's really, really good. And she has a child out of wedlock, and her mission is this child disappears. So she is the driving force behind this whole story. There's also a Florence Nightingale trained nurse who does something quite heroic in this story. So I mean, it's not something that I consciously said, oh, I've got to stick smart, intelligent women. They just are there because I write what I'm interested in, and I assume that, you know, people who read Sherlock Holmes are interested in smart, exciting people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and so then in Unquiet Spirits, there's either, yeah. There's definitely some, yeah, the client or one of the clients is a woman who's actually a bit scary. And then there is also, there's a doctor. Now, women at that time in England could not get their MDs, but they could in America. So this woman is Scottish, but she went to America to get her MD, and she's working as a physician. And at one point, he says, "You know, people don't want." She said, "They don't like to see women with blood on their hands." So, you know, but she's really quite good, and she ends up doing something. So I didn't like go, "Oh, I've got to stick smart women," and they just are there. I mean, I am a feminist, but I don't think about that all the time. I primarily identify as an artist, and I just do my art. And I am a woman, so it is informed by that. So,
well, thank you very much, Bonnie, for the woman and the artist that you are.
Thank you.